So it's very, very important to practice even when one has normal daily life activities happening. One still has to practice. And there's various ways of applying the mind while one practices daily life activities. For example, you can keep your meditation word, Bodhicam, with you while you're walking around the monastery. Or while you're doing something, like for example, you're painting something, or you're sanding down something, or you're sweeping something, that's very classic because it doesn't demand much extra attention. You can just simply stay with your breath and watch the movements in contrast to what you're doing, or like in accordance with what you're doing. There's other situations where, like, maybe the activities that one has to do are quite quick, and you have to improvise. You have to be in a mode of like watchfulness, and you cannot really retreat. Even the meditation word "butoh" is kind of a retreat situation. You're going inwards instead of applying your mind with external things. But for example, a classic situation: if there's like a katina going on, a monk's festival, so to say. There's two or three senior monks here, and all of them have to be either served with fresh juices and coffee or so, or like the old things have to be taken away. And at the same time, you have to watch out like that, you know, like that you don't spill the glass and that you get the right drink for everybody. So being like a waiter, so to say, it happens here. We practice to be a waiter or a garçon. And you need another kind of mindfulness. So if you were to practice butoh in that moment, you'd probably not get it whether the senior monk wants tea or cocoa and mess it all up. But like what then comes into play is that precision of being present and also being alert and being attentive. That's also a very valid practice, like to be able to be very alert and sharp and observant. That's more the applied kind of mindfulness and wakefulness practice. That you're watching and you're aware of, like the signs. For example, one of the senior monks makes a sign that he needs to go to the toilet, and you immediately get it and you show him the way, or so. Whereas if you were just looking at the floor and going butoh butoh, then he'd probably bladder burst without having anybody showing to the toilet in time. These kinds of things, they're real skills to have the right balance between attentiveness and introvert practice. And then both can be done while one is doing daily life activities. Yesterday, talking about this thing about panya, and panya not being supposed to be up in the head, more or less, but related to one's own kind of like cultivation of things that are relevant for one's own situation, say, of practice. So we have that approach that meditation sometimes is like a bit like something you do systematically, and you do, of course, like with an idea about where it's leading to and what's it supposed to be like, and what are the possible insights that one anticipates. So, like, definitely we do have all that quite a bit. And if you think about our friends in the Thai Sangha, sometimes I think there's little of that notion of like being up in the head or being kind of planning ahead what to do directly or which insights to anticipate, understand, or so. One could say many of our friends are very intuitive about their feeling around the role that they're in, like as a monk. And one way we can see that is that, like, just the ease and the happiness that many of our friends display of just simply being in the robes or sitting on the asana or giving the blessing, it's just like it really comes like intuitively with faith with many of our native Buddhist friends. And it was like we sometimes still have that little kind of thing to do to rationalize or understand first before we do something. And one way to get out of one's head is just to focus on one's body and to be able to bring back one's awareness to what is happening around one's bodily posture. So to practice on the level of having one's bodily movements beautiful and nice, and be aware of where one's going and how one is moving. And again, there's a lot of like rules around that, and we can take hold of the wrong end of the stick again if we focus too much on the core what and think, am I supposed to do this now? Am I supposed to get up now? And am I doing it correct? Will I be sitting on the right spot or in the wrong spot? That's not the kind of bodily movement that leads to intuition. But what leads to intuition is like to open up and observe while doing all these things in the group or in the sangha. The other one is like that I find very valid, which we don't notice how much we're actually practicing this, is through all the kawats and all the monastic rules, we're constantly practicing body awareness. For example, when you're sitting now, you're sitting nicely, neatly, and you're not just kind of casually, or like when you get up, you bow, or when you approach a group situation, you're aware of your body heights and the sounds that you make, for example, just simply to be able to sit down in an assembly, say one is a little bit late for the morning meditation and comes in when everybody is meditating, just to simply be able to produce no sounds while one is entering a room. It takes a lot of concentration actually, and also a lot of like awareness of your body and a general sense of willingness to do that in the first place, say a sense of heedfulness. You're coming in there noticing, actually this is a quiet situation, I need to be invisible and inaudible. Whereas with a normal average daily life conduct, say the way that people walk to a bus station or enter a bus, you know, you just don't care whether anybody takes offense of your physical appearance or not. You just claim your rights, you're in there. And I noticed that a lot going back to Germany, like the average daily life movements on a normal street are already like elbowing each other, like for my sense of awareness. Everybody goes his own way and nobody evades each other. Whereas like in Thailand, even in families or so, or like in houses or in staircases, there's a culture of being constantly aware of one's body, and that there's rules about who is allowed to get how close to everybody. The body language is something that people internalize, and for us it's a matter of being aware of that and learning it. For example, if you've got an old woman walking somewhere as a young lad, even if you're 1.80 meters tall as they are these days, then you just kind of duck down, which is like a function of mindfulness, awareness and applied practice. Whereas like in a average daily life in a secular society without any of those rules, you just kind of walk and go your way, and you'd even bump into the old granny, not noticing her sometimes because she's 3 feet smaller than you. And then if you're still well-mannered and you still got a sense of like caution, you say sorry afterwards. And even that, sometimes people are too coarse to. So just simply to walk in the monastery without making a sound, something that we have to learn. For example, with the flip-flops, it's considered very coarse to walk around and making sup-sup noises, for example. Actually, when I'm sitting in my office, I can almost for certain tell who's walking up the staircase. Sometimes, like if somebody's really mindful, I don't know that somebody is coming, but usually I know somebody's coming and I can actually tell differences between people. The level of refinement of walking up a staircase that slightly reproduces vibrations through a building is something I notice. And similarly, I guess you'd be able to notice, like, say Vajrakevili's got a bad day and he's scattered and produces this and that sound or so. You'd also notice, especially if you've just been meditating, and you're actually still kind of like adapted to some silence in your mind, and your hearing is like a bit more refined, you'd notice that. And I really like this part of the practice, like to be so cautious and unintrusive. And I think Thai culture has picked up on that, like in the worldly habits as well. And the body language of people here is much more kind of, I would say, graceful, much more restrained generally. I don't know how much it changes, but like generally there is a sense of that. And it's something that children learn in school as well. You get these posters in the kitchen. I think there were three and there's only one left because we don't have enough space. But they show like what's good manners for school children. It is something that people have internalized, and it is coming from a spirit of respecting each other and giving space to each other. And what effect it has on one's own mind, it educates one to be unintrusive and silent, not to make oneself a nuisance to other people, for example. It's a culture that I think it doesn't exist so much in Germany, at least. Like once you got a point, you got to make your point, and you got your rights to say things. Whether you say it in a loud voice or softened voice, it's your right anyway. So the idea of adapting to the situation in a right, refined way, and speaking gently, speaking at the right time, and even that there are right and wrong times for saying things, that doesn't so much exist in my country. Like that, once you've got a point, you got to make it. It doesn't matter whether people are ready to listen to it or not, whether you say it respectfully or not, and whether you say it with a red face and breaking out in sweat, or whether you are calm and quiet and you just say what you need to say and finished. You're making an offering. You can put it like that. But like generally people just a bit like out of their mind and much how much importance they give to themselves. You can see it in body speech. And I remember one, maybe I might mention that before, I don't know the exact quote, but one of the quotes from the time when in my lay life, I went to various Zen retreats, and there was a saying, wherever he goes, he makes no sound, wherever he moves the air doesn't make turbulences. It's a German one, I forgot how it was. And wherever he treads, he leaves no traces. And then it says, why is that? Because he takes no notice of himself. So today in this afternoon, we'll be continuing our pre-Pansa or beginning of Pansa visits to pay respects to our senior elders in our tradition. And as already announced this afternoon, we'll go to see Longpo Anik from Wat Basaingam. It's about 45 minutes or 50 minutes from here, and we'll leave at 2 o'clock. Be there, meet Longpo Anik at the boat if it doesn't rain at 3 o'clock. And when going to see Kru Bhajans, for example, you can observe one, the Kru Bhajan himself, like the way he walks, the way he kind of gets into his sandals, the way he pulls his sitting cloth over his seat, for example, even the way he drinks or like the way he bows, you know, all kinds of things. Not everything is perfect, but like you generally observe that there's a flow in it, and that these people are in their body, and that they are mindful and intuitively humble and gracious about it. So then you can see sometimes like the deferential gestures around the Kru Bhajans. You can see how invisible somehow people are serving from the back, from the sides, from below, and how unintrudingly this all works without much explanations in a good case. And like sometimes like you also have like people that are not yet there, and they also knock over spittoons or like a tower over the Ajahn or so, but like many times it's just done very beautifully. And to watch that scene and be part of that is also a practice of mindfulness, and it's also a practice of awareness. One could even say it's Kayagata Sati and the Sampajanya of the first part of the Satipatthana. You could even say, go as far as that, because it says stuff like that, like putting on his robes, like holding his bowl, He's Sampajana Kari Hoti, you know, he's somebody who makes Sampajanya. These kinds of things, like sometimes they're good for us as well to get us out of the head and slow down our kind of quick, assertive like expressions of ourself, and just to be in tune and downplay ourselves and try to fit in and observe what's most harmonious. Make yourself invisible and yet do the right things. So that's something I wanted to offer when we go to pay respects. We also have attention to how we are, like in the group, in the situation, and are we observing, say, for example, there may be drinks that are passed around, and sometimes we're there and we're focusing on the Dhamma that we're listening to, and don't notice that somebody else is actually bringing us something to drink and or whatever, you know, like there may be lots of things going on, or like quickly you see Lompo Anik is getting up and Shankivali has fallen asleep, and the first row doesn't get it, so the second row may be just about like graciously there to get up and take his walking stick or something like that. That kind of thing is very beautiful. And if it comes like with intuition and with body awareness, it's always beautiful, it's never wrong. And the gestures of humbleness also, they're always like, they're immediately felt. Whether it's like the right thing to do or not, it doesn't really matter, but it matters how you do it. Like say when you approach then the hour long pause, then just to do it just beautifully and be aware of, like be in tune. So that's Sampajanya and Satipatthana.